Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to History Rage, the podcast where we invite our leading historians to unleash a surprise attack on historical perceptions. The podcast where we storm in with overwhelming force to deliver a knockout blow to the myths. I am your regular host, Paul Bavel, and I am here with my loyal co-host and one-man army, Kyle Glover.
Hello!
So a fortnight ago, we closed off Series 10 with our 100th episode, and this week we're back with Series 11. And I've waited some considerable time to say this, but, and I'm sure you'll agree, Mr. Glover, this makes us more popular than friends.
Official.
Take that, Schwimmer. Take that, Aniston. Yeah, in your face. We got more series than you did, but like friends, maybe we should have stopped at Series 3. I don't know. Listeners out there, I will let you decide. But this week, loyal listeners, we are kicking things off with overwhelming force as we welcome historian, author, director of the Chalk Valley History Festival, and co-host of a rival podcast that you may be aware of, and returning rager, the legend that is James Holland. James, welcome back to History Rage.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. And I should say, now that it's Christmas, we're no longer called the Chalk Valley History Festival. We're now called Chalk.
Just Chalk.
Yes. I mean, you know, we're not beating about the bush. It is still a history festival. But, you know, we realised that all the best festivals just have one name, with the possible exception of Isle of Wight. You know, you think Glastonbury, think Wilderness, think Festival, think Reading, think, you know, whatever. Hey, they've all got one name. So Chalk Valley History Festival just always sounded a little bit village fate. And while we don't want to lose our village fateness, we do want to kind of appeal to a broader audience, definitely. And I like chalk because chalk, you know, if it does mean something to you, it means W.H. Hudson, Shepherd's Life, tumuli, ancient droves, Lynchets, Coombs, beautiful ancient chalk downland, etc., etc. And if it doesn't mean any of those things to you, it's just a nice word.
Yeah, isn't it just?
With an E, I should say.
With an E, indeed. Yes.
Chalky. Chalk.
So, at time of recording, we're about a month away from release of the next book, Savage Storm. And by the time of the release, that will be out, and I expect most of the independent company will have bought it already. But for those that are not IC members out there, James, can you tell us a bit about that book and what we can expect from it?
Yeah, sure. So it's the Italian campaign in 1943. So I've done the whole Italian campaign completely the wrong way around. So I started off doing the last year of the war some years ago, called Italy Sorrow, which was, you know, kind of Rome through to the end of the war. Mm. Then I did Sicily, which is obviously the start of it. And then I thought, well, I better do the fill-in bits. And originally I was going to do one big long book that was going to take us all the way through the invasion, all the way through to the fall of Rome. But actually I've split it into two. So Savage Storm is the bit in 1943. It's actually the bit no one ever knows about. Because usually what happens is people write books about Casino and they sort of go, oh, yeah, before this is how they got to Casino in the first place. It's, you know, it's a chapter if at best. But it's these incredible battles and, you know, from the heat of summer when they all land in late summer in September 1943 through to truly atrocious winter weathers at the end of the year with lots of rain in between. It's an absolutely brutal campaign. It's brutal for all involved, whether you be German, whether you be Allied troops, or whether you be civilians caught up in the middle of it. And one of the things I've been trying to do with this book is really take the writing on a level. You know, you don't want to ever become complacent. And I've been trying to sort of play with form a little bit. So all the action sequences are very sort of truncated and you know, slipping into what we call the historical present, which is where you kind of sort of move into slightly into the present tense, just to give it that kind of sense of immediacy. But I suppose the big thing is, you know, my books always kind of follow a cast list of characters. So very defined characters that as a reader you get to know. And they're your kind of human drama conduit through the main events, whether they be an Italian civilian, whether it be a German soldier or Canadian, British, American, whatever. And what I've done this time is try to use contemporary sources as much as I possibly can. So diaries, letters, that kind of stuff. And if I have used a published memoir, it's a published memoir that's been very strongly based on a diary that was kept at the time. So you're telling the whole thing absolutely in the moment. So there's no authorial forward projection. There's no kind of knowing, wink, wink, we know when Rome's really going to fall, all that kind of stuff. There's none of that. It's absolutely panning out as it unfolds for the characters that I'm following. And I think it's much more affecting because, of course, if you're relying on oral histories, self-evidently they've survived because otherwise they wouldn't be talking to you 50, 60, 70 years later. Whereas with the diaries and letters, you don't know whether they're going to survive or not. And actually, so it's that whole sense of jeopardy, and not all of them do. So, you know, you can really get to know someone. And that's the other thing is I think when someone's writing a diary or writing regular letters, particularly if you're an officer where you can be a lot more open than you can if you're the other ranks because you're self-censoring. So you can be, you know, you can say a lot more. What you find is their characters really burst forth off the pages. So you really get to know their 21-year-old, 27-year-old, 32-year-old self. And you get to understand and be able to empathize with these characters. And you can't help but get involved in their lives and their struggles and what they're going through. And it's incredibly affecting. And when someone does then suddenly get blown to pieces by a, you know, a 155 millimeter shell or something, it's really upsetting. It was upsetting for me when I was writing it, and hopefully it's upsetting for the people that are reading it as well. Because the whole point is, you know, you're trying to get readers as close to what it was like out there as you possibly can. So you're trying to kind of evoke a sense of place and time and landscape and all the rest of it, but you're also trying to kind of get people to identify with the characters. And you know, L.P. Hartley at the start of The Go-Between very famously wrote The Past as a Foreign Country, you know, and historians love kind of sort of churning out that line. But actually, one of the things that's completely apparent from reading all these diaries and letters is the past is not a foreign country, in so much that these characters are absolutely identifiable. You know, you and I would recognize these characters, their responses to the situations they find themselves in. And so that makes your ability as a reader or as a writer to connect to these people much stronger. And I think the net result is something that's considerably more powerful than if you're depending on oral histories.
It's one of the things that I really liked when I was reading Brothers in Arms, because you mentioned earlier there, you don't know if people are going to suddenly get hit by 155 or anything like that. And he did in Brothers of Arms. He did fantastically, where you would be just following somebody along and then, bam!
They're gone.
As suddenly as it would have happened at the time as well. And the pace of it, everything just carries on. And literally, you have just gone like, there you are with this guy, and then, whoomph, he's no longer there. But that momentum carries on with that gap very obviously there, both in your mind and on the page. I really found that was quite powerful.
Well, good. I'm thrilled you say that, Paul. And I've got to say, I find it really at the end of this is grueling. I mean, it's fascinating. The characters are fascinating. The campaign as it unfolds is absolutely fascinating. The battles, which most people, including myself, before I got involved in it, really didn't know anything about, whether it be Ortona or Sonia or Monte Camino or Crossing the Volturno, whatever it is. There's all these battles, which for those involved, it's absolutely life or death situation, and it's the most important thing that's happening in their lives. But it's been forgotten to history, and it's been great to bring them back to the kind of forefront to a certain extent. But it's also been fantastic to learn about them. But it's also been just absolutely unbelievable. And of course, you know, what they went through, what they suffered, what, you know, whatever side, incidentally, or whether you're civilian, what they had to put up with. And writing this when there's a backdrop of another European war, I think all of that has made the whole experience much more gritty, interesting, disturbing, upsetting, all those sort of things. But you know, if you don't want to be upset, don't read about the Second World War. That's the bottom line.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So, well, while we're talking about people getting upset about the Second World War, then, let's get into today's rage, which I know has been simmering under you for a while.
Yeah. Well, there's lots of things that really get me going, Paul. And this one particularly is just so annoying. It's the whole thing about putting the Germans on this pedestal that I don't think they deserve. And it all starts with Blitzkrieg. And everyone's sort of going, yeah, you know, the amazing pioneering brilliance of Blitzkrieg. You know, we never seen anything like it before. This is new to the world, this new tactic. It's kind of like the Basball of warfare or something, as though no one's ever operated like this before. You know, people have hit sixes before Brendan McCullum and Ben Stokes came along. And actually Basball is more pioneering than Blitzkrieg, because Blitzkrieg is not pioneering really at all.
That was, I love the cricket metaphors in there as well, you know.
Well,
never far away.
Can I get in with a question then? What's Basball?
Okay, so Basball is England cricket in the last few years has been really, really poor. But Test cricket, which is the purest form, and we've been really bad at it. And in the run-up to Ben Stokes taking over as England captain, captain of the England Test team, we'd won 2 out of 19 or 17 Test matches. I can't remember what it was, but it was absolutely terrible, terrible record, including a 5-0 drubbing against Australia. Or maybe it was 4-0. I can't remember, because one of them was a draw. But anyway, I mean, we were absolutely drubbed, and it's been awful. And what happens is Ben Stokes came in with Brendan McCullum as the new coach. He's a New Zealander. And they introduced a new kind of fearless cricket where you just go and smack it and express yourself and don't worry about being dropped because you're not going to be. Just go and do your thing. And their ethos is, we want a team of people who on their day can change a match. You know, when they will find their moment if they're given the chance. And you take away the pressure of playing for England. You take away the pressure of worrying about your place. And you just play your natural game with freedom and with a sense of liberty. And it has absolutely transformed the English Test team. And they've become the most exciting Test side in the world, bar none. They're the best to watch, the most exciting. And you know what? Most of the time they're winning. And it's been absolutely transformative and amazing. And I think the way that Blitzkrieg is painted is that everyone else has got stuck in the mud. No one else was doing anything exciting. No one had thought about how to fight a war. And suddenly the Nazi Germany comes along in 1939 with this new style of warfare, which no one's ever seen before. And it's completely brand spanking new and brilliant and inspirational. And do you know what? They're winning too. And they are doing the winning bit, certainly in 1939 and 1940, for the most part, but not entirely. But it is nothing like as pioneering as the myth would have it. And that's the key thing. It's absolutely what the Germans have been doing for as long as the sun has been rising and setting every day.
So what are the military campaigns or historical examples that predate the Second World War that utilise these similar sort of blitzkriegy, basball-y style of tactics?
Literally every war that Germany and before that Prussia has been involved in.
Okay.
Literally. So you can go back to Frederick the Elector, you can go back to Frederick the Great, you can certainly go back to more recent times, 1864, war against Austria, war against Denmark, 1866, war against France in 1870, start of the First World War, and the 1939 and 1940, and certainly the Blitzkrieg in the West in May 1940. They're all exactly the same. So what do I mean by that? So Germany is caught up in the middle of Europe. And before that, Prussia, the largest German state. It's in the middle of Europe. It doesn't have access to the world's oceans. It has a little bit of the Baltic coast, which is a sort of mess of narrow channels and islands and what have you. Little bit of the North Sea coast, but certainly for the last, you know, previous 150, 60 years before, certainly 150 years before the Second World War, that had been dominated by the Royal Navy and the Spanish and the French, and certainly not the Prussians. Prussians don't have a navy worth talking about as well. So their access to the world's oceans is negligible. And they don't have many natural resources themselves. And they know this, and they know their limitations. So the whole way they fight their wars, and this goes back, it's not quite as old as the hills, but it's certainly as old as Frederick the Elector, which is sort of, you know, early 18th century, is to fight a very, very fast war where you are using operational skill and tactical flair to do your hard yards. And what you do is you attack with great force at your Schwerpunkt, your main point of impact. So at the point of impact, you have superiority. What you then do is you then do a thing called a Kettelschlacht, which is the cauldron war, which is effectively an encirclement. So you go bam, then a second hit, thump, and then you go like this, the horns of the bull. And then you go right behind them and you encircle them and you annihilate your enemy and you win in a day, 3 days, a week, or in the case of 1939, a matter of sort of 3 weeks, 6 weeks, whatever. But you do it really, really quickly. And you do it really quickly because you haven't got the natural resources to get involved in a long, drawn-out war and where supplies, logistics, and resources are going to be absolutely key. So lightning-quick war, and blitzkrieg means lightning war, i.e. very fast, the whole notion of operating fast, which is not blitzkrieg, it's bewegungskrieg, which is the war of operational skill, is their mantra. That's what they've always done. And the point is that sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. So it works in 1864 against Austria. It works just. It works very successfully in 1866 against Denmark. It works to start off with against the French in 1870, but then sort of slightly peters out, which is where they don't really get beyond Paris. And it looks like it's going to work in 1914, but then doesn't. So what they're doing in 1939, particularly with the Blitzkrieg in the West, the Case Yellow, the launch of the attack on the 10th of May 1940, is exactly what they've always done, i.e. massive punch, draw in your enemy, second punch, massive encirclement, the Kettelschlacht, the Schwerpunkt, Bewegungskrieg, you know, because you can only do that by being really organized and having your supply lines lined up. So in this case, in 1940, it means they've all got lots of pervitin. It all means that, you know, that they've got fuel dumps all the way to from the German border, all the way to the Luxembourg border. They've got their kind of, you know, supply lines. They've got everything sorted out. They've got their kind of running orders. They're going to get to the River Meuse in 3 days. They're going to get across it in the fourth. You know, this is absolutely classic Prussian stroke German approach to war. Nothing has changed at all. There is nothing original about it anyway whatsoever in concept. What is different about it in 1939 when they go invade Poland, 1940 when they go into Scandinavia and subsequently on the 10th of May go into the Low Countries and France is that they have better communications than they did. But the principles are exactly the same.
So you mentioned a few there instances where Blitzkrieg failed to achieve its objective.
Well, because it's the only way they can do it. They can't afford to fight these battle stroke wars or campaigns in any other way. So it's a roll of the dice. You do all your prep and then you just go for it. And you go for it with speed and you do your Kettelschlacht. But obviously it doesn't always work.
Yeah,
okay. Because they lose. So, you know, IQE 19, you know, for example, yeah. The First World War.
Yeah, so can you give us some examples then of when it doesn't work and how it doesn't work, both wartime and pre-war, if you like?
Yes, okay, well, in 1870, it all starts, you know, the French are completely knocked off their feet. They don't know what's going on. They lose Alsace and Lorraine. The Germans get to Paris, but then they completely run out of steam. The French sort of, you know, get themselves organised and it comes into a settlement in 1871 where France hasn't, you know, has lost, in inverted commas. The German state has been announced in the Hall of Mirrors in Versailles Palace, which is always quite a weird thing, really. And the Germans have now got Alsace and Lorraine, but they haven't won anything else. So it's a kind of, you know, it's a victory to the Prussian stroke Germans, but it's not. It went on a bit longer than planned, and it was successful, but not as successful as they'd. It was better than losing by a substantial margin, but it wasn't as fulfilled a victory as they'd hoped. Obviously, the classic one where it doesn't work is 1914, where that, you know, they're trying to do the sickle cut and all the rest of it, and they're trying to do this big sweep through the Low Countries, and it all looks like it's going fine. They've, you know, knock out Belgium and all the rest of it, and advancing on Paris, but then they get halted because they kind of, you know, their supply lines get too long and the resistance is too strong, and they just don't pull it off, and then they get ground down by, you know, 4 years of trench warfare, both on the Eastern Front and in the and the Western Front, and it all goes horribly wrong, and they lose the war. So absolutely doesn't work then. But if you want to, if you want a classic example of this, of how it's all exactly the same, so German troops in the Franco-Prussian War cross the River Meuse at Goliers, which is just, you know, a matter of half a mile from the city centre of Sedan in northeast France, and they cross at this old, it's called the, what's it called? The Goliers Draperie. It's like a clothing factory there. And they cross at this particular spot in 1870. And guess what? They cross exactly the same spot in 1914. And would you be surprised to know that on May the 13th, 1940, they cross again at exactly the same spot. This very, very same crossing spot to a matter of sort of 50 yards or so either side. And the amazing thing about 1940 is that on the other side of the bank, where there's a little kind of tiny little floodplain before it rises up again, there are no French defences whatsoever. They were supposed to have mines there, but the mines had got a bit rusty and a bit damp over the winter. So they pulled them all up again and were about to replace them, but hadn't quite got round to it. And there were no bunkers whatsoever. There was no machine gun posts. All of them were in a further kink on the river, a little bit further to the west and to the east.
Yeah.
And so where the Germans crossed for the third time in what are we talking about, 70 years, there were no French defences. And guess what? They got across okay.
It's one of the things that would always like poked at the French when people have ripped the Maginot Line, etc. But there is like a traditional route of invasion into France from Germany.
Yes. So it's all like there isn't any defences at Sedan. There are defences at Sedan, but not at the crossing point. There's three crossing points, to be fair, at Sedan. But the number one crossing point, which is where Guderian goes over on the morning of the 14th of May. It's where the first rifle regiment crosses on the 13th of May, where they, you know, where that all happens, is the exact same spot. It's absolutely extraordinary. You literally couldn't make it up. And this goes to my second point, which is actually the Germans are spectacularly predictable.
Yes. Which we will come to in a later question.
So the whole point about Blitzkrieg is that it's not predictable. This is something new. And what I'm saying is no, it isn't. It's exactly what they always do. It's just that now they've got new toys. They've now got a Luftwaffe and they've now got radio sets. And that's what makes it different. And they've got, you know, and obviously the advancement of modern science, they're bringing that to the fore. And that's, you know, quite right too. And any sane attacking nation would do the same. I mean, you know, the weaponry of 1870 is an advancement on what it was on 1770. Mm. You know, the weaponry of 1914 is an advancement of what it was on 1870. So of course it's going to be more advanced. But the principles behind it are exactly the same, right down to the crossing point.
We were talking earlier about a place that, or an example of where it didn't work. Now, this will be more Kyle's field of expertise than mine, but one I've always thought that was an example of actually this lightning strike just not really panning out for the best is Crete. I'd be interested to hear both your thoughts on.
Well, to be honest, I rest my case. I mean, you know, Crete should never have been a German victory. It's a terrible decision, you know, because it's coming a mere 4 weeks before the largest military operation ever mounted in the history of the world, which is Operation Barbarossa, the invasion of the Soviet Union in the third week of June 1941. And they're using their most important aircraft, transport planes, of which they don't have very many, and they're using their best trained troops, the Fallschirmjäger, the paratroopers. And both of them get slaughtered, both transport planes and paratroopers get slaughtered. And this is where the brilliance of German tactical nous and Blitzkrieg has to be countered with ineptitude of the side that they're attacking. And, you know, The Blitzkrieg of 1940, Case Yellow, the invasion of Low Countries and France, is 50% German skill and brilliance, operational brilliance, and Bewegungskrieg, as opposed to Blitzkrieg, and 50% French ineptitude. And I would say that it is 70% British ineptitude on Crete and 30% kind of chutzpah of the Germans. For, you know, they're obviously highly motivated, well-trained troops. These, the guys that are coming in, both the Gebirgsjäger, the mountain troops that follow, and the initial Fallschirmjäger drop. But it is a series of mistakes. I mean, it is giving up Malemi airfield, you know, putting too many troops in to prevent amphibious assault, which General Freyberg, the British New Zealand commander, has picked up on Enigma. You know, and actually, for all the kind of fame that Enigma has, and this is the decrypts of German coded radio traffic. For all the brilliance of it, it actually, you see, if you overall, if you look at all the kind of Enigma breaks, there's almost as many times where knowing what they've discovered from cracking Enigma is as detrimental as it is beneficial. And I would say that Crete is one of those ones because, you know, Freyberg puts his men in the wrong place, and he absolutely, you know, the decision to give up the airfield in the far west of the island is catastrophic.
I would say it was a Allied defeat rather than a German Axis victory.
Yeah, and I think, you know, to a certain extent, you can say that about France in 1940 as well. I mean, the difference is, and this is the interesting thing, is when we think of panzer divisions, for example, and it's panzer divisions that are leading the way, panzer division isn't a formation that is just stuffed full of tanks. It's an all-arms motorized formation of motorized infantry, motorized anti-tank guns, motorized artillery, motorized reconnaissance troops, motorized cool people with BMW motorbikes and sidecars, and of course tanks as well. But the common thread is that they can all communicate with each other. And the really interesting thing is that although Germany is not particularly mechanized in 1939, and certainly not compared to France, Britain, or the USA, is way, way, way behind. There's a scales on that front. And that comes with all sorts of problems, such as if you haven't got a very automotive society, then you haven't got lots of people who know how to drive, and you haven't got lots of people who know how to repair, and you don't have lots of factories making it, you know, which when you suddenly want to become a really mechanized army that's going to invade the Soviet Union, you've got a problem on your hands because you just don't have enough men to do what you need them to do in terms of maintaining, keeping, and understanding how mechanized world operates. Be that as it may, in 1940, they've got enough to be able to do what they need to do. But what they do have in the summer of 1939 is they have more radios per person in any other country in the entire world, including the United States. And what they've realized is that radios don't need to be an aspirational thing, you know, a big, lovely wooden thing that were covered in sort of walnut veneer that you know, only the aspirational classes can afford. A radio needs to be something that everyone can have. And so what they do is they create these people's radios, so the Kleine Deutsche Fanger, which is the Deutsche Kleine Fanger rather, which is the German little radio, which back in the day was, you know, as revolutionary as the arrival of the iPod was. It's sort of totally transformative because rather than a huge, massive, great wooden box, these things are, you know, 9 inches by 4 by 4, and they're made of Bakelite, and they're super cheap. And even if you can't afford them, they've still got them kind of blaring out in the air, in the stairwells of flats and apartment blocks and public spaces and restaurants and bars and all the rest of it. And what the Nazis start doing is just bleating out the same old stuff a whole time. You know, it's not just Hitlerian waffle and spittle going everywhere. It's more subtle than that. But the overall message is, we're freaking great. We're the best in the world. We're naturally martial people. We have the best military in the world. We hate Jews and we hate commies. And we're gonna win the world back, and we're gonna be the best nation ever in the whole world. And everyone who's been sort of a bit downbeat and downtrodden after the defeat of the First World War goes, hooray, sounds great, count me in. You know, feel a bit awkward about the Jews, but you know, maybe they got a point. And I've never liked Bolsheviks anyway. So that's how they get the buy-in. But the military are going, oh, hang on a minute, we've got all these really small radios. That could be cool. What about if we put those in our groovy BMWs with sidecars? Or what if we put them in our little armored cars in our reconnaissance troop? Or with our motorized infantry or with our anti-tank guns or in our panzers? And everyone goes, yeah, this is brilliant, because then we can exploit, you can have the big breakthrough. There's never been a problem with the Schwerpunkt. You know, we know how to, you know, we're dictating the pace because we're going to attack. So we can decide where we're going to attack, and we're going to surprise the enemy because we're going to move really fast. And the great thing is, this is what we couldn't really do in the First World War, is once we've found that weak spot and burst through it with our Schwerpunkt, we can then exploit it and pour through with artillery and panzers, the hole that the infantry has made, because we can all communicate with each other. What's not to like? And that's the difference. But the principles are exactly the same. There is nothing revolutionary about Blitzkrieg. It is that they now have the means to be able to do it in the way that they've always wanted to do it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So we've got three questions now by our loyal subscribers. So Kyle, do you want to dive in with the first one then?
So this is from Simon Clark.
Thank you, Simon.
Why were the Germans so obsessed with dive bombers?
Well, you have to remember that this has all been developed in the Luftwaffe is announced to the world in 1935. They've been doing stuff beforehand. They absolutely see air power as key to their future military success. And they're also trying to do it as practically as they possibly can. And the theory behind dive bombing is that by dive bombing, you're getting closer to your target, which means you'll be more accurate, which means you need fewer bombers and less ordnance to be able to achieve what you want to achieve.
Sounds sensible.
As opposed to droning over in a massive swathe at 25,000 feet, dropping a whole load of eggs and hoping that, you know, some will crack. So on paper, it's an entirely pragmatic decision. But there are inevitably some issues with it, because if you put all your eggs in one basket, if people suss out how to defeat dive bombing, then you've got a problem on your hands, because suddenly you haven't got the ability to bomb from huge distances away with huge amounts of ordnance at 25,000 feet. You know, that's gone because you haven't developed it. So, and the shortcomings with dive bombers is it's fine when the target is big and you can see it and it's not moving around, and when you control the airspace, then dive bombing is great. The problem is if you don't control the airspace and your target is moving, then dive bombing is really, really difficult. And you're also very likely to be shot down, because as a dive bomber, particularly a Stuka Ju-87, which is, you know, your classic thing with the siren and all the rest of the Jericho trumpet and the wailing thing and all the rest of it, all very terrifying psychologically. But as it comes out, it puts on these air brakes. And as it comes out of its dive, it's basically hauling itself out and it's almost at a standstill. And if you're a Spitfire, a Hurricane or a French Marine or a Debortine and you're hovering above it, that means you and your Stuka are an absolute sitting duck. Because what makes something very difficult to shoot down is when it's moving around really fast all over the sky and making itself a very hard target. But if you're almost at a standstill in the air and you can't really maneuver because you're just trying to pull out of this dive, that makes you incredibly vulnerable. So fine when you've got control of the airspace, not fine when you haven't. And the trouble is what they discover in the Battle of Britain, for example, where they don't have control of the airspace, they're trying to gain that airspace. Stukas are getting absolutely slaughtered because they're coming over in formation and they're trying to bomb these targets, and the Spitfires and Hurricanes above them are having an absolute field day. And the other problem, of course, is that if you're on a ship trying to escape from Dunkirk or wherever, and you're a Stuka trying to attack it, you've got literally 0.0 3 seconds in which to hit that moving target, because you're starting your dive at something like 8,000 feet, which is quite high, and you're dropping it at maybe 1,000, 1,500 or something like that. Well, at that height, a destroyer full of troops of the BEF coming off the beaches from Dunkirk looks like a pencil, you know, and it's moving around all over the place. The damn bugger's not keeping still, you know, so it's really hard, which is why 338,000 people get away. I mean, the number of ships which are destroyed by dive bombing at sea once they're in motion is something like 6.
Really?
In the Dunkirk evacuation. 335 vessels that are lost. There's only 11 Royal Navy ships that are sunk. The vast majority are small craft, you know, private.
Yeah.
Launches and what have you, and yachts and stuff that get the little ships, and most of them are lost to misadventure, which is too many people trying to get on them and they sink. There's actually comparatively few which are sunk by Stukas or dive bombing JU-88s. And the problem is they're so pleased themselves about Stukas, they then start giving dive bombing credentials to absolutely everything, whether it's a JU-88, which is originally designed as a very fast, long range medium bomber. But then the Luftwaffe go, well, you know, we'd like some dive bombing capabilities of it. And the good people at the Junkers sort of do huge amounts of teeth sucking and say, well, we can do it, but it's going to cost you. And it's going to cost you in terms of time. It's going to cost you in terms of performance. And it's going to cost you in terms of Reichsmarks, all of which come horribly true. Yeah. But they've gone down this path, and they, you know, it's a route in which they're struggling to kind of pull themselves back from, which is why they then go to this ridiculous decision to try and turn a Heinkel 177 four-engine heavy bomber into a dive bomber too. And you know, obviously it doesn't take an aviation genius to tell you that trying to make a heavy four-engine bomber into a dive bomber ain't going to work, and it doesn't. And the Heinkel 177 manages to kill 32 of the best pilots the Germans have, their best test pilots in trials.
Given all those failings of the dive bombings that you're going at there, is that a reason why we don't ever really go for it? Because you don't hear a lot about us.
Well, we do. We have the Vaulty Vengeance, and there's dive bombers in the Pacific and all the rest of it. You know, they're very good. They are good if you're trying to hit an aircraft carrier or something like that, which is a comparatively big target. But yeah, you know, it's fundamentally fatally flawed. I mean, you know, you've got to have control of the airspace for it to be successful, or else you're going to be slaughtered. And, you know, if you think about the Battle of Midway, I mean, even when they're destroying... The Americans are destroying Japanese aircraft carriers. They're still absolutely getting smashed themselves. You know, it's dive bombing comes with all sorts of problems. And also, obviously, by the time you're coming out of your dive, you're really, really close to the deck. And that gives you very little wiggle room to sort of escape. Whereas at 18,000 feet, you can all bail out. You know, you can afford to have a bit of a dive and a wing fall off and jump out. Whereas no such chance if you're only kind of 500 foot or 1,000 foot off, you know.
Yeah, I suppose if you say you're trapped, I mean, I'm no pilot. I'm much more of a sailor than a pilot.
Right.
But I imagine if you are pulling out of that dive, if you suddenly in the middle of that have to take an invasive action of suddenly swing yourself
you're just going to fall
out of the sky, aren't
you? Yeah. And you can't take evasive action because, as you say, you'll either stall and drop. So you and that's the problem with Stukas. So when the Stuka force, you know, is involved in the Battle of Britain, they get absolutely slaughtered and get withdrawn out from the battle after 10 days. So that's 400 of you, you know, that's what you started off with, 400 of them. They've gone. They're out of the battle. So that's 400 of your bombers gone.
Yeah.
So this next question is from good friend of the show, AD Bond. Is Blitzkrieg vulnerable to air attack on the logistical tail more so than regular operations?
No, I don't think so. No, because any tail is any rear area is always vulnerable if you don't control the airspace. I mean, the Blitzkrieg was because of the huge amount of, particularly when we're talking about Case Yellow, the invasion of Low Countries and France. But the key point was that Army Group B was going through the Low Countries to draw the French, the British, Belgians, and Dutch towards them, so that the main thrust would come subsequently from Army Group B, and that was going to come through the Ardennes. But because of the nature of getting through the Ardennes, which is this area of hills and rivers and narrow roads and all the rest of it, is so the infrastructure is comparatively poor. What that means is all those roads are absolutely crammed with the route march, the marching orders of these various divisions, which are supposed to be in the lead. You know, one group going to Dinant, another one going to Monterme, another one going, you know, the Guderian one, the main one going to Sedan. And so all those roads are absolutely log jammed, and they're made worse because the infantry commanders don't think there's any future in this and disobey their orders and start moving off earlier than they should do and get completely in the way of the route marching orders of the panzer divisions. So the idea was that, you know, there's a limited number of roads. Okay, you can be on this road and this road and this road. You can, you know, this panzer group can be, you know, corps can be on these three roads. The next one can be on the next ones, and the next ones, next ones. But if your infantry start cutting in, they're cutting in. You know, the panzer division is going one way, and the infantry are cutting in on them, going another direction. You know, so roughly the same direction, but not exactly the same direction. So what you end up is with a sort of tail to bumper, bumper to bumper gridlock.
Mm.
And of course, that does in that particular instance make them incredibly vulnerable. And French reconnaissance planes were going over and going, zut alors, you know, what is all this? And reporting back. And the French higher command were going, this is, you know, c'est non impossible, or n'est pas possible, or whatever. Yep. And so they ignored it. But had they sent over, had the French gone, right, Brits, French, get all your bombers, we're going to the Ardennes, and let's just smother them, it'd have been all over, it'd have been totally game over. There wouldn't have been a Second World War.
Yeah, have they looked at that and gone, oh, look, there is a giant military buildup on Germany's traditional route into France?
Yes, because there was huge scepticism from the German elites, of the traditional Prussian elites who were still in command of the army. They just thought this new idea was bonkers. It had no chance of success or very little chance of success. And they all thought they were, you know, they were invading France and they were doomed to failure, just as they had in 1914. So what would have happened if the panzer divisions, which is absolutely the spearhead, you know, these are the units which are doing all the hard yards in the invasion of France. They're the ones that are defeating the French army. Had they been set back in terms of time scale, badly damaged, knocked off course, unable to get across the River Meuse, et cetera, game over.
Yeah. Okay, well, this leads us neatly into the last of our range of questions that we've got here, then, which is from Anthony Carroll. So thank you very much, Anthony. So he's basically saying, if German tactics and strategy, you know, are so good, then why do they go on to fail? Why do they never seem to learn? As you say, they're doing this tactic for the last 100 years. It's got a checkered level of success. Why do they not learn?
Well, I mean, you know, they have this great victory, and most people in Germany think by July 1940 that they've won. But they haven't, because they haven't defeated Britain. And that's because they've completely failed to understand that from Britain's point of view, losing your army is bad news, but it's not the biggest bad news, because their senior service is the Royal Navy. So it's really important when you're attacking someone that you understand your enemy and you understand what makes them tick. The problem is with having Hitler as a warlord is he views everything through the narrow prism of his own worldview. And his worldview is that land power is everything, because he's a land-loving continentalist. So the problem he's got on his hands is that he assumes that Britain is going to sue for peace, and Britain has no intention of suing for peace. So then he's got a massive problem on his hand, because he hasn't got an air force that's designed to operate strategically, i.e. on its own without supporting ground forces. And they don't have enough to do what they need to do. So in the whole of the Battle of Britain, out of 138 airfields, they managed to knock out one for more than 48 hours, which is not a really good rate of return. And it's all very well saying, well, you know, the Luftwaffe is 3,500 strong. Well, yeah, it is on paper, but there's a difference between paper and reality, and there's a difference between reality and what's actually available on any given day. So most days, you know, they've got a bomber force of perhaps, you know, 400 or 500, and they've got sort of 600 or 700 fighter planes, and that's not enough to do what they need to do. And they're sending out these little penny packets going in low to attack these airfields, and what they discover is that kind of, you know, 15-20 Dorniers or Heinkels, which are twin engine medium bombers that can carry little more than about a ton of ordnance, that's not enough to destroy a 100-acre airfield, a grass airfield. It's just not enough. And the British have anticipated this, so they've got lots of sort of piles of scalpings and bulldozers and all the rest of it ready. So once the Germans are gone, they just kind of fill in the holes and crack on again. And, you know, Spitfire's taking off kind of 2 hours later. And so that's why they don't knock out the airfields. They haven't got a coherent plan how to do it. And this is the fatal flaw in the whole thing, that the moment it starts dragging out into a long, attritional, drawn-out war, the Germans are odds-on likely to lose because they don't have the logistics and the supplies and resources to be able to support them. They don't have access to the world's oceans that the world's largest empire, Britain, does have in 1939, 1940. Mm. And with America kind of waiting in the wings of its huge, you know, manpower, industrial potential, et cetera, and frankly, oil fields, because the largest oil producer in the world is America. And we're now in a mechanized age. And the Germans simply don't have the oil to be able to support the mechanism which they're trying to impose on their enemy. And I'll give you an example of this. So in 1944, total oil production for the Germans is 4.5 million tons of oil, whereas domestic use of Britain, domestic use, so not military use, not overseas use, but domestic use in Britain by the British is 22.5 million.
Wow.
You know, you're just not going to win. You're not. So the reason they don't learn is it's not because they can't, because they've slaughtered their best men in 1939 to 1941. They're now in a state where the Nazi state is getting its control is getting tighter and tighter and harsher. So the replacement officers, which are replacing the kind of traditional Prussian elite and the mm-hmm. professionals and the people who actually know what they're doing, they're being replaced by people who are Nazis first and foremost, rather than brilliant soldiers. So they're really hot on discipline and Nazi ideology. So they're not going to run away, and they're going to keep firing. They'll shoot anyone who does run away. But that doesn't make them brilliantly trained soldiers.
Yeah.
And so the whole thing goes pear-shaped, and they just haven't got enough to do what they want to do. And everything they do just gets them in more and more of a pickle. So, you know, you start using slave labor because you haven't got enough labor yourself because you're sending them to the front where they're getting slaughtered. And so slave labor is obviously never going to be as productive as labor that's motivated and well-fed and from the nation in which they're doing the production. So, yeah. You know, you're getting yourself into a spiral of pickles, of difficulties, which you can't get out of. And so they don't learn. And what their reaction is always when attacked is to counterattack. And the Allies work this out. And so what they do is they go, well, we're going to probe forward with our infantry and our armor, and we'll wait for the Germans to counterattack, because they always do. So we'll try and keep those infantry and armor to an absolute bare minimum. And what we will do is we'll build up our artillery and firepower, and the moment the Germans counterattack, we'll just smash them. And that's exactly what they do.
Because Germans, if nothing, are predictable, as we...
There you are.
So I'm going to wrap this question up then. So, if, as we say, then this has been the German standard mode of attack for over 100 years, Germans, if nothing, are predictable, at least at the time militarily, how is anybody at the time surprised by this?
Well, that's a very good question. And one of the problems is you've got an alliance of nations in 1940. And the background to that is you've got lots of very old men who've won the First World War in French commanders. They're too old. They're too stuck in their old ways. Mm. They're kind of like the old bloke who doesn't want to embrace modern technology. You know, what is this TikTok? It's that kind of thing. Mm. And they assume that the next war, having been quite senior commanders, you know, people like sort of Gamelin and Georges and Billot and Weygand, you know, all these people have been quite serious commanders in the First World War. You know, they're not kind of majors in the First World War and now generals. They're all generals in the First World War and still generals or brigadiers or senior colonels or whatever in the First World War and now generals. And they assume that the Second World War is going to be exactly the same as the First World War, but with more firepower and better bunkers. And so what they planned on is that they've assumed that the Germans can't move any quicker because they're hugely mechanized and mechanization takes a long time, and they won't go through the Ardennes because it's impassable to panzers and all the rest of it in huge amount of mechanization because it's too backward and rural. And they assume that what they'll do is they'll meet any attack that the Germans first have. Then they've got all these mobile reserves, which all in the fullness of time they'll build up, and then they'll counterattack and smash the Germans. And that's what they think is going to happen. But what they've failed to do is put in adequate communication, so they don't have the little radios that the Germans do. They don't have that means of communicating. So the Germans in 1940 were able to beat the French in sort of penny packets rather than ever operating as a whole. So it's this whole idea of the Schwerpunkt. You want to operate, you know, have a massive concentrated force rather than spread out penny packet force. But I think the other reason why you've got this situation with France is because France politically is very dismembered in the 1930s. There's lots of something like 13 different governments. They're all coalitions. It's all over the place. And if you don't have political unity, you'll never have military unity.
Well, thank you very much, James. Thank you. That was an education. It really was. Have you had fun?
Yes, obviously.
Excellent.
It's been good to get it off my chest.
Excellent.
Good. I'm sure you've got a great many. I mean, you know, I would love to get you back to do Hugo Boss didn't design Nazi clothing. You know,
yeah, but only last 3 minutes.
Yeah. Well, we did that one on video. So anybody wants to check out our YouTube channel, that one is on there.
Very good.
But thank you very much, James.
No, it's absolutely a pleasure. Good to see you, boys.
If you'd like to know more about this subject, then, of course, you can start by buying James's book, The Savage Storm. We're going to have links to that in the show notes. You can also find him and Al on the fabulous We Have Ways of Making You Talk podcast. And if that's not enough, then you can follow him on Twitter at James1940. At time of release, we will have all enjoyed ourselves a great deal at We Have Ways Fest, but I understand that the plans for We Have Ways Fear are already open.
Absolutely. Always. Always thinking ahead, Paul.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. We would really appreciate any reviews you could leave for us with Apple, Podchaser or Amazon. You can follow us on Twitter at History Rage or individually. I am at Paul Bavel.
But I am at Kyle G History.
And if you're loving this, then please support us on Patreon, because that really helps support our podcast. Your £5 per month will get you early episodes, entry into all of our prize draws, the invite to put questions to future guests, as many have done here, and of course, the coveted History Rage mug. And you can subscribe at patreon.com/History Rage. But until next week, from all of us here, stay angry. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.